Hello, listener, and welcome to episode 83 of Good Copy, Bad Copy, the B2B copywriting podcast. We know it's a strange time, but we're going to keep going as best we can. I am sorry if the sound quality isn't quite as good as you're used to. This month, we're talking about agile and lean agile content for B2B to see whether processes from engineering and development can teach us something in B2B copywriting too. My name's David Maguire. I'm creative director at Radix Communications. And as this is the first episode without Fiona co-hosting, we've invited a very special guest co-host. Welcome back, Emily King.
Hello, everybody. Oh my gosh, it's been so long.
It has been forever. Yeah, it's so good to have your voice back on the podcast. You're content coordinator at Bluefruit now?
Yes, at Bluefruit Software, yeah.
So what's that? How long have you been there? Tell us about it.
Well, it was, you know, it was my year anniversary as this whole apocalypse was kind of like kicking off. So like I've been there now just over a year. I started off doing a bit of a freelance for them, and then they were like, could we have you, please? And I was like, sure, because he doesn't want to work with like one of the biggest growing kind of like tech companies in Cornwall.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. And you're a content coordinator. So is that sort of like all kinds of content or marketing content? What kind of stuff are you into?
It's mostly marketing content with a side of sales and a little bit of like kind of recruitment. I've been advising on some of our internal stuff. We're like trying to improve some of our internal documents a bit and some of the stuff we send to clients, because obviously there's a lot that I learned whilst I was at Radix that's kind of like applicable in terms of stuff to do with style and clarity. So
cool. Well, I hope so.
So we're trying to help with that a bit.
Sounds amazing. And how's the apocalypse treating you?
Well, it's pretty good. I've got the advantage that there was a bedroom in the house that we were partway through clearing out to turn into an office. So we've kind of got the minimum viable product of just kind of like half the space cleared. Behind me, there's an old mattress that's covered in a sheet and like some clothes on a railing, all stuff that we were planning to take to the dump and then stuff closed. So I've got a tiny desk and I've just got about enough space to work, basically.
I was like, points for the first mention of the phrase "minimum viable product" in a podcast about agile content. I imagine that phrase might come up again.
There is a high chance, yeah, there is.
it's probably good to give the listener a bit of a view of where we are, because we're not in the normal place. Normally, we've been doing this face to face. Of course, I'm actually in my kitchen. I'm looking out the window, got the harbour, the Penryn River out there, and I'm currently fighting for bandwidth with two teenagers who are home from school. Well, one teenager and one nearly teenager. So if we get bandwidth issues, I shall go away and shout at them.
Yeah, I'm only having to compete with my partner. He may or may not be streaming YouTube videos, so... Oh.
You can't really stop it, can you?
No.
Emily, it is wonderful to have you back on the podcast as our first guest co-host. Listener, as always, we want to hear from you too. So if you have any thoughts or comments on this episode or life in general and, you know, surviving under lockdown, do email us podcast@radix-communications.com, or you can find us on Twitter at radixcom. That's RADIXCOM. Soon we'll be talking to Emily's colleague, user experience expert Dan Goodwin, about where the user fits into the content picture. But first, let's talk about agile and even lean agile content for B2B. Emily, I think it's fair to say that agile gets misunderstood in marketing a fair bit. Could you talk us through what it is, really?
I mean, you are right. It does get misunderstood. I think it's kind of like everyone over the years has jumped onto this term of sort of agile and just kind of run with it without, unless of course you're sort of in software development, really, without having a real appreciation of what it means. If we consider that the Agile Manifesto was something that was put together almost 20 years ago now, it was first published in 2001, and the Agile Manifesto of Software Development had kind of like some key themes and principles and stuff, but it's these sort of key manifesto ideas that are kind of the ones that are very exchangeable. They have a lot of crossover to a lot of industries, a lot of things where creation is taking place, whether that's obviously a piece of software, a physical product, or, you know, words and media. And the kind of the core principles underpinning it are stuff like individuals' interactions over processes and tools. It says working software over comprehensive documentation, which we can pick apart in a minute, customer collaboration over contract negotiation, responding to change over following a plan. So that, and that last one, in a way, that's where that whole idea of it's reactive and changeable kind of comes from. And you'd think that it doesn't like plans and planning also from like that last point, but actually, and the kind of processes that we do at my work, especially that we try to think about, is that planning is perhaps even more important than having like an actual plan. It's the process of everyone getting to a point of understanding, having the same understanding, shared understanding of what we're trying to achieve, when and where, and then also understanding how to make change happen whilst doing all of this, and how to keep communicating and collaborating whilst trying to make anything happen, basically.
It sounds really, really complicated.
It is really complicated. And you've got people that spend ages like trying to get qualifications and stuff in it. Like it's not something that comes easily. Certainly if you've worked in a more traditional work environment as well.
Yeah, I mean, I know that it's something where, and I think it's partly to do with the misunderstanding that we get, is that as when we get briefs and things through from clients and they talk about that they follow agile processes within their marketing team and that kind of thing, what we then, as a supplier into that sense, what we 7 times out of 10 know is coming is a brief that's going to keep changing and really, really, really short deadlines. But that's probably not the best way to deliver that in a marketing context. I'm guessing that's not the essence of it. That's just because someone is saying agile when they just mean changing their mind a lot, right?
I would say so. Unfortunately, I mean, you can change your mind if it is based on actual evidence that has come forth. Like if you were in the middle of doing some campaign right now that had something to do with something you can't do due to the current crisis, and you were looking to get it out whilst this crisis is going on, if you weren't stopping to think, oh, maybe we need to rethink this at this point, it'd be kind of crazy not to. Certainly if you're working to a true agile way, you would take that moment to reflect on new information sort of coming out. Or more importantly, if you were working in a real agile way, you wouldn't try to do a whole load of kind of big design for campaigns and stuff and planning up front. You'd actually try to think about how you could break it down into smaller parts and kind of build up on it in increments, doing that kind of minimal viable product kind of thing, actually, with your marketing, thinking about, well, you know, the first thing we need maybe is like a website for this thing, and it needs to at least have this page and this means of reaching someone. And then you sort of get that out, and then you start thinking, okay, and then this kind of traction, we'll make some changes to that, but then we'll think about these other activities we could be doing, and just kind of slowly building up based on evidence that you're getting as you go with everyone that you're working with, and kind of building out from there rather than just going boom, launch into one big thing, or you're at least trialing stuff with a small audience.
Okay, so it's a lot of sort of testing and building from the small individual things up towards the big, rather than starting with kind of a big strategy view and breaking it down from there. Yeah. It's building up from the bottom and testing as you go. Is that?
Yeah, I'd say that would be a sensible way of thinking about it. Yeah.
Cool. But you go further than that with your work at Bluefruit Software. You're doing lean agile. Is that right?
Yeah, we're doing lean agile. I suppose for those of the listeners who are kind of familiar with like lean manufacturing processes, yes, it is coming a bit from that. But more specifically, our idea of lean agile is actually based on lean software development, which was an idea put forward not long after, you know, the Agile Manifesto was put forward, like a few years later, I think, by Mary Popadick and Tom Popadick. If I'm pronouncing the surnames correctly, great. If not, I'm so sorry. and they wrote a book about lean software development, where they kind of took kind of more of the practices and processes rather than necessarily the principles of Agile, and kind of looked at it through with kind of like a lean manufacturing mindset, and kind of like sort of shifted thinking towards things like because lean has stuff to do with like empowering people. There's a huge thing, like eliminating waste is also like a really big part of it, and amplifying learning. Those are like key principles in this idea of kind of lean software development. So what we kind of do with Bluefruit is we kind of smush the two together, where we kind of have more of the lean principles kind of overseeing everything with a bit of Agile kind of in there. The stuff that Agile does that sometimes kind of conflicts with lean, but we kind of get this balance going.
Okay. And for the listener who doesn't kind of understand what a lean software development or a lean manufacturing environment is, or maybe not be that familiar with principles of the Agile manifesto, what does that actually look like in a marketing context? Like when you're creating your content, how does that, you know, what kind of things do you do differently from what you might have done before?
You kind of don't start anything until people are properly sure that that's a direction they want you to start in. You push back. You're like, you challenge things. You go like, is that genuinely what you want now, what you need now? And it's having that communication available so that you can kind of collaborate together as partners rather than kind of being subservient one way or the other. So you can talk and you can be like, and you know, are you sure before you start putting massive amounts of effort into something? And if you come up with stuff whilst you're doing this, if you come up with learning about, you know, that something's not working, you don't just keep plodding along at it. You actually do stop and you do open up communication with other parties, stakeholders, you know, and just be like, we've run into this. Can you work with us to get past it, see what the issue is? Or can we find another way to work with it or around it or something? Like, you actually problem solve together as you go.
And if that is something where, is that easier if you are dealing with in an organization where in the development side, they already work in a kind of lean, agile kind of mindset? I guess for a marketer that's not in that kind of organization, pushing back in that way might be difficult.
I can understand. Yeah, it would be difficult. And the thing is, it's kind of starting with those small things. Like the biggest thing you can do is, if you're not doing that, is that if you are sort of starting to work together with people on that, it's making sure that you do just communicate effectively at all times, and that emails aren't always the answer. Like, lots of words in an email, text can get misinterpreted. Like, pick up the phone and call someone, or, you know, start a Zoom call or whatever these days. Or you can also make sure that everyone gets the chance to reflect regularly on what's happening. You know, so like things like retrospectives are a huge part of both Agile and Lean Agile, or even Lean software development, like where you actually take time on a regular basis to get the people who are making the thing and stakeholders together to actually look back on how things have been going and see where improvements can be made, if there's anything that needs to be stop or if there's anything that needs to start. You know, and unfortunately, if you can't have that kind of two-way communication going on anyway, then I'd say that there's deeper problems at heart than working in an agile or a lean agile way.
Yeah, I think you're right. Unfortunately, kind of a lot of marketers do face that. I don't know if you saw our research that we did on barriers to great B2B content, but I think was it 81% or something, 81-82% of people feel that they have to fight hard just to publish content that they're happy with. I think stakeholder alignment seems to be a big part of that, and in the research that we did in the survey, the advice that we got from Doug Kessler, you know, was to take that process of stakeholder alignment outside of the day-to-day business of signing off content and that kind of thing. And I guess that in a way, these kind of retrospectives and that kind of thing could sort of work in that same way to help you kind of create on an ongoing basis alignment in your organization about what good effective content looks like.
I mean, yeah, it could, and I think it would certainly work with like more content, like let's say content planning formats that people are familiar with, like editorial calendar meetings, you know, stuff like that. Like you can have that meeting where you have people who you're trying to get aligned and have an interest in stuff succeeding, in actually being a part of those meetings. And you could start that meeting off with the kind of the reflective part and then move on to the part where you agree what's going to be worked on in X period that you're agreeing that stuff's happening in, you know.
Yeah, and I guess acting as a true partner, you know, that cuts both ways, and the stakeholders in the organization need to treat you as a partner as well for it to work. I'm keen to bring in our interviewee in a moment, but just briefly before we do, have you picked up any good lessons along the way, either implementing lean agile content or, you know, in building your content program at Bluefruit Software? Is there, are there any good lessons that a marketer can take away?
Really, the main lesson out of any of this is communicate. That's the biggest one. It's talking. A lot of the stuff that lean agile enables is frameworks, processes, ways to feedback, to talk, to collaborate, to reflect, and then using the information that's gathered from any of that to adapt and make sure that what's being made is the right thing for the right time and for the right people.
If a marketer wants to know more about this, wants to try lean agile within a marketing context, where should they look for more information?
I currently haven't found any books that I like. That's from a kind of a marketing perspective, looking at Agile, Lean Agile.
So, it's there for you to write then, isn't it?
Perhaps. I have been working with Dan, actually, and company founder Paul Massey on a series of blog posts on Lean Agile. And while it does have a software development focus, I'll admit, we've written it in such a way that it's kind of more accessible to a wider reading group. Like, you don't have to be a developer to read those posts. They're more for business leaders and people sort of beyond sort of not necessarily working with code day to day. So we've kind of got some reasonably accessible content there. I think also checking out Big Up for Coolmore and Agile on the Beach. They do have sort of business leadership tracks and stuff that are to do with, other ways of thinking about Agile that aren't just to do software development. And all of their past talks are on YouTube. So cool. If you want to feast on audiovisual content about working in agile ways, Agile on the Beach on YouTube, tons of content.
Emily, would you like to introduce our interviewee for this episode?
Yes, I would. So what if Agile and Lean Agile aren't the only practices that we can apply to B2B content? Well, actually, definitely there are more. So I'm lucky enough to work with UX designer Dan Goodwin. He joined Bluefruit Software not long after me, actually. And he knows some great things to do with user-centered design. So I thought it'd be interesting to kind of find some common ground. So welcome, Dan.
Hello.
Hi, Dan. It's good to get you on the podcast. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm delighted to be on the podcast. I've listened to it a fair amount on Laugh, so it's a real privilege to actually be brought onto it. So yeah, nice to be here. Thank you.
Oh, that's very kind of you. And how are you? Are you kind of keeping safe and well and indoors and all of that?
Yeah,
kind of thing?
I'm safe and indoors. I've got a bit of a challenge that I moved house probably about 3 or 4 days before everyone was locked down. So I'm in a house which is lacking lots of things, including soft furnishings. So I've ended up cowering away in a bedroom to record today because my house is kind of empty and echoey, which is weird. But health-wise, all good. So yeah, we're carrying on.
Cool. So Emily, what did you want to ask Dan on behalf of the listeners?
Oh my goodness, there's so much. I mean, because I didn't get to think about UX enough. But I suppose what's kind of important for me to try and understand, something that I have to wrap my head around on a regular basis, is where does the audience fit into Agile and Lean Agile?
Yeah, that's cool. And the and where you're saying users and audience, I think that's a really good point that we ought to get out of the way. There's always a debate about the label users and user-centered design. And there are plenty of other things that people would like to call these people. We could be calling them users, we could be calling them customers, audience, or humans. There's a label human-centered design. So I'm going to talk about users, but I mean all of those things. So we're just talking about people, right? That's quite important to get out of the way. And so to get to your question, if we take a look at the 12 Agile principles, so that's kind of a guiding light for people following Agile. Right there at the top, we've got the very first principle. Number one is that our highest priority as a team is to satisfy the customer through early and continuous delivery of valuable software. And you can probably tell I had to read that because I can't remember all these things. And there's one really important word in there, and that's valuable. So we want to deliver things that deliver value to our user. And how can we ever do that if we don't understand what's valuable to them? And that means understanding those people, our audience, our customers, understanding what they're doing, understanding their challenges, understanding their needs, their behaviours, what they do. So we need to understand those users, those people, to deliver that value. And you've talked a bit about Lean, and one of the key things about Lean, if we kind of layer that on top of Agile, Lean's keen on reducing waste. So we're always looking for ways to reduce waste, not do things that are wasteful. So we don't want to implement things which our users don't need. And if we kind of think back, perhaps to times past, products and services, they might have differentiated themselves through lots of features. We get into this kind of feature war situation. More features equals a better product. We've got this feature, our competitors don't. And that's taken us to products and services that have loads of features, but unfortunately, they're often features which users don't want, or they can't use because they can't find them or they can't understand it. So the more features we pile on, the harder things get to use. So if we kind of, the smart people out there are flipping that on its head and we're taking time to understand those users and to create products and services that solve the problems and meet the needs of those users, rather than piling on feature after feature. So we've got less waste. That gives us a better product. That means happier users, and that means more sales. And we've reduced waste, so we've reduced our operating costs. So bringing users into the design process of anything that we're working on is kind of a no-brainer, really.
And Emily, from your point of view as a content coordinator who's working mostly with marketing content, when you're hearing Dan talk about continuously delivering valuable software and focusing on the functionality and the things that the users really value. Do you essentially just do those principles, same thing in your content, but instead of software, you say content, and instead of features or functions, you say information or something like that? Is it as simple as that, or is it more complicated?
No, I think it translates over really well. It helps that stuff like UX thinking came a lot out of it, sort of the current stream of it came out sort of from designing digital products and stuff. So there's a lot of crossover with like how marketing shifted basically since like Web 2.0 and that. So it's familiar. It's something that I can certainly work with, and I don't actually have to translate that much to myself. But it might be just because of the kind of business I've been working in for the past year.
I mean, if we think about it, it's absolutely about our making our content meet the needs of the people who we want to read it. So those people are our users in this case, and if we're helping those people, again, understanding what their challenges are, the way they read and consume content, the channels they use, at the kind of levels that they understand. If we build an understanding of those things and we follow what we learn as we produce our content, then it's more likely to get read and used by those people.
So how do you find out what those users, customers, audience, humans, whatever you want to call them, how do you find out about them and what they want?
Yeah, so my absolute favourite, my number one, and we'll dive into some challenges around this, but my number one favourite is to talk to them, is to have a conversation with those people. And when we have conversations, it's about asking the right questions. So we're going to talk to our users about the things which are important and which make up our user needs. So we're going to ask them about what they're doing, their context. We're going to ask them about their challenges and their goals, their problems, their behaviours. What do they do? What do they do day to day? We're going to have a conversation with those people, get them to walk through what they're doing in a typical day or a particular task or challenge that they've got, get them to walk us through that. So having conversations with people, and crucially asking the right questions and capturing what we learn, that's the very first step in terms of finding out about those people.
Great. And though, how can you do that? I'm very conscious that in the research we did, 78% of B2B marketers say they have a problem getting access to customers. And in big enterprises, it's like 100%. So are there ways you can find out what you need to know without actually talking to them?
Yeah, I mean, there are. And I think I would say we'll talk about some ways that you can, but I would think you should always endeavour to find a route to talk to those people. Always try and find a way to have conversations with people. But to kind of get you there, to get you on the way to that, or to do it if you haven't got direct contact, you've got to use the resources that are available to you. And that might mean tapping into the people across your organisation and finding the people who do spend time with customers. So that might be people like sales teams, field sales teams, or support staff, field engineers, field support engineers, or account managers. So find the people who are spending time with the customer, with the user, and talk to them about customers and their needs. And again, thinking about all those things that are really important to us, those things around context and goals and motivations, the challenges that users have. So if you get your whole team, your whole organization, understanding the kind of things that you want to know, that you want to learn about, they can be out there having those conversations, and they can bring you back the kind of helpful insights. So UX as user researchers love insights. So you want to kind of get your team bringing those useful insights back to you. And that's kind of a goal. And there are other things you can do. You kind of go where your users go. So you can do things like go to the right conferences. Obviously, not a great time to be doing that right now. Online, so forums and and chat rooms and things like that, which your customers are using. Find out where they're reaching out to peers for help and listen in on those conversations, and use things like LinkedIn. LinkedIn's a goldmine of information around job roles, the kind of jobs that people are doing. How have they moved into those roles? What's their background? You'll find people posting up questions to their peers, and those questions are often about the challenges that they face. So you kind of use all the resources that you've got available to you and gather those useful insights around the things that are most important to us around those users.
So Dan, like, once we've got this information, whether it's obviously in the ideal world of like directly from the customer or through our associates who do have that kind of customer contact going on, what can we do with that information to turn it into something that's kind of usable? And I do get the feeling of something that perhaps we want to keep up to date as well.
Mm-hmm. So this is where you'll probably find people talking about personas. Let's talk about personas. And one of the first things that we learn, if you spend any time kind of reading and following UXs and following what they're saying, we quickly learn that personas are kind of a bit of a hot topic of debate. There are lots of people out there who really don't like personas. They don't like people using personas. They don't understand why they're being used. So it's kind of a bit of a Marmite thing out there. For me, personas, so we're talking about finding ways to present a group of users and their needs and kind of context and goals and motivations, presenting those group of users as a kind of a fictionalized presentation of a user. And I think it's that fictionalized presentation that people often get hung up on. And for me, personas are useful. And actually, it's really the act of creating a persona that's the most useful thing. We're kind of working together as a team, using the people across our organization to kind of build that shared understanding of our users. And building a shared understanding is a really important concept in user-centered design, and indeed in Agile as well. So we're following a process to learn about those users and the things that are really important. We're using the team to do that, to kind of gather those insights, have those conversations. And then we'll probably work together as a team to produce those personas. But it's actually the kind of the process of creating them, the process of going through and talking to users and learning about them. And the personas are kind of acting as a means to remember that process, to remember those people. So we end up with kind of A4, A3 printouts of a representation of our group of users. But that's just taking us back to everything we've learned, everything we've been through as a team, helping us remember that group of users. So every time we then make a decision, design something, write an article, we're going to come back to those personas, think about our groups of users, and think about everything that we've learned about those groups of users. So we've got that in our minds as we're going through that design process or through that article writing process. So personas are a really useful tool for me because they help us remember everything that we've learned about our users.
And how can a B2B copywriter or a B2B marketer start to include users or customers in their content creation process?
So I think it's all those things we've talked about. So at the very least, before putting pen to paper, that's a horrid cliche, which is probably not true of B2B content writers, I'm sure. Before we even start writing, we want to think about the people that we're trying to reach, that we want to read this whatever it is that we're working on. So start thinking about our users, our customers, who's going to be reading this stuff, and think about those important things, the context, their challenges, their goals, the problems they've got, the environment they're operating in, the organizations they're operating in. So be thinking about all those things. And if we're struggling on that, then we want to go out and have some conversations. We want to try and learn about some of those people. And maybe that's having a conversation with other members in the team, those salespeople or those support people. Or maybe it's kind of trying to reach out to some of the people on LinkedIn and saying, could you spare me 10 minutes to have a conversation about some of the challenges that you've got? So we're kind of using whatever we can to learn what we can about those users, and then working on what we're working on, and keep bearing those users in mind. And the thing is, if you keep doing that for each piece of content that you're working on, you'll build that understanding of those users over time. You know, every 10-minute conversation you can have with a customer, you'll learn more about your users and their needs. So kind of have it as an ongoing process that you're going to learn something, going to feed that into your kind of insight bank, those personas, your understanding of those people, and you're going to write and learn from them. So kind of do it as an ongoing thing, so it's not a massive kind of upfront research burden, just kind of an ongoing process about user learning and user understanding.
And then I guess from that, going back to the lean principles, going back to the agile principles, when you're then looking at delivering content that is valuable and therefore won't go to waste because people actually value it, you know, it's stuff that is useful to those people and is driven by your understanding of those users, rather than we ought to have some content about this or a thing that you came up with because you thought it was a cool idea or because your sales team asked you for it, right?
Exactly right. And I'm sure that's something that that content writers will frequently get. Somebody will go, oh, I saw this thing and that gave me a cool idea and we should write about this, we should do a blog post about this. And at that point, you want to take a step back and say, okay, so who is it that's interested in this thing? What are their challenges and goals? And the person who's made that request, they may have some ideas, they may have some preconceptions themselves about the people they want to reach, or they may not be sure. And at that point, you're going to then put a bit of effort into thinking about who this content's going to be useful for. And that way you're helping the person who made that request to start thinking in that user-centered way as well. And that's important. We want to get that kind of mindset across an organization, because if the whole team's thinking in the user-centered way, then everyone's going to benefit from that.
So Dan, what's the best way for listeners to perhaps read up or watch up or listen up a bit more about this and maybe even follow up with you?
It's probably worth, we haven't talked about any books or references or anything. There's a couple of books that I'd recommend. One is a book by a chap called Steve Krug called Don't Make Me Think, and it's been around for a very long time. It is very much about user interfaces and UI design, but it's about doing those things in a way that meets the needs of users. And it isn't, I would recommend it to anyone who wants to think about users in as part of their process, and that should be everyone, right? It helps you get into the right mindset around thinking about the right things that are important for our users. So I'd recommend that book. It's nice and easy to read. It's a great introduction to user-centered thinking. The other book that I'd really want to recommend, that I end up recommending a lot, is a book called The Mum Test, or Mom Test, so American for mum, so it's Mom Test. I'm not a big fan of the title, I'm afraid, but I am a massive fan of the book. What that book is about finding every opportunity you can to have useful conversations with customers. How you can ask the right questions of customers, learn the right things about customers. So not questions about product or service or features. We don't want to ask our users, oh, we're thinking about adding feature X. Would you use it? How would you design it? You don't want to ask users things like that. What you want to ask people about is about themselves and about what they're doing, about their context, their challenges. People like talking about themselves and about their challenges. So ask the right questions. And the Mom Test is by Rob Fitzpatrick. That really helps you get into that mindset of using every opportunity you can to ask the right questions and learn the right stuff about our users. So I'd recommend those two. And beyond that, people can find me on Twitter. So I'm Bouncing Dan on there. And I'm the same on LinkedIn. So people can find me on there. So people can try and fire questions through to me, and I'll do my best to help them where I can.
Thanks, Dan, for sharing with us. I'm sure there are plenty in the audience who will be giving user-centered content a try. Emily, we'd normally have our Anonymous 5 feature about now, but unfortunately, what with one thing and another, we've had to postpone that for a little bit. So instead, before we go, I wonder if I could pick your brain really quickly. We had a question the other day about how to get subject matter experts more engaged in the marketing content process. And I know you've worked with a lot of engineers in particular, and just wondered if you had any quick tips you could share on that.
I think one of the biggest ones is that when you're trying to get information out of them, because they work on amazing, incredible things. First up, you kind of need to be specific whilst not being specific, because you might not know what they've worked on, but they also respond better to specificity, being specific, you know, in language. So if even if you kind of suggest what might be the wrong thing, they'll correct you and then actually tell you about the thing you actually do want to hear about. But then they also have this really bad habit, and I haven't found an effective way that I can repeat again and again about how to get around this, but they quite often think that something they've worked on is unremarkable. But actually, it's the exact opposite. It is remarkable what they've worked on. And so it's kind of teasing, you need to be able to tease out from them those remarkable moments. And quite often, it is when you feel like you've got to the end of a conversation, and actually what was meant to be a 30-minute call has only lasted 10 minutes. Actually, that's when you need to start maybe shooting the breeze a little bit and kind of like picking up on what they've previously said, so you can kind of try and burrow in and get out more of the actual cool stuff that they've been up to. So be specific, and don't let go. They almost always have done something remarkable, even if they don't think they have.
You are so right. You are so absolutely right. I remember I literally had I worked with an engineer who was writing a piece, and he thought that the fact that they had developed motors that were being used on the surface of Venus, or were going to be used on the surface of Venus, was no big deal, which because they'd already been to Mars, so it's only another planet. So, yes, I wholeheartedly agree with that. Thank you. That's really helpful.
You're welcome.
Well, that's all we have time for this month. Emily, thank you so much for coming back for this one to hold my hand. It's a shame we couldn't do the recording in person. Thanks also to Dan Goodwin for your time and wisdom. And thank you, listener, for bearing with the slightly strange sound quality. Do remember that if you'd like to get in touch, you can send us a voice memo to podcast@radix-communications.com, or you can find us on Twitter at RadixCom. It would be especially good to hear from you at this weird time. All content is pretty good, I reckon. Until next time, please stay indoors and stay safe.
Bye.